Okay, good morning. Bio 231. And it is September 27th. Okay, so let's see. The stuff online for you, the lectures online, you can listen to them if people find those helpful. And then over the weekend, I forget if I told you this or not, I decided to open up parts of modules that I developed for the Anatomy Hybrid class for you folks, so that you can go onto your Blackboard site and use the interactive exercises for labeling pictures, and you can take some online quizzes, and none of this will count toward your grade, right? But it will just give you a lot of practice and using the language of anatomy so that when you come and take the test, then it would be easier, right? But the most important thing that you should study for a lecture exam is what? The study guide. That's right. So these other online materials will reinforce the study guide, but the most important thing, of course, is the study guide. All right, so that I put in weekly enhancements, so you can click on weekly enhancements, and for instance, if you go to appendicular skeleton, there's some objectives for you to look at, but then here are the interactive exercises that you can practice labeling, like for instance, the scapula, right, glenoid cavity, where would that go, here?
No.
Here? No. Where are you going to look? Somewhere on the lateral border, which is over here. So glenoid cavity I like right there. And there's probably some, I don't think I have the sound turned up, but there's some sound too. So if you say it right, you get it right. And you can do it what? You can do it 100 times if you want to until you get 100%. All right, so that's some exercises. Let's see what else we have. More exercises. I got some videos. Some of the videos are nicely narrated. Some are not. Here are some that are not narrated for you to watch. Oh, 3 of 8. So here's another one. Essential Study Partner. This is like an online book, but there are interesting labeling exercises in this area, too. It works best with Internet Explorer. Okay, it doesn't work with Firefox for some reason. So this you should, I think I probably have a comment. Yeah, use Internet Explorer as a browser. And let's see. Oh, and then here are some online quizzes that you can take and get feedback to see how you're doing with multiple choice type questions. And so those are sort of like the questions that you have at the end of the chapter in your book, except you get immediate feedback. And here's a really good tutorial on the various different limbs with some quizzes so that you can practice your understanding with that material. And again, some quizzes. Okay, and what is this right here? Ah, this is a particularly good website by somebody in Phoenix, Arizona. Let me just see if I can label this thing. Like for the skull, for instance, anterior view. Right, so you can hover over the different bones. You can say the name of this bone in your mind. Like what bone is this right here? Nasal bone. And if we click, you'll see what? Ah, nasal bone. So you can just look at all these things. Oh, what do we got right here? Infraorbital foramen. Right, so it will tell you. So you don't have to type these in, but that maybe would help for the practicum, right, because then they would check spelling for you. But anyway, you can run through all the different pieces of the skull. So have fun with this stuff if you wish. Okay. And so the links are right there for you in Blackboard. Okay. All right. So we were talking about joints or articulations last time. And there are two general ways that we can classify joints. One is by a structural classification, and then the second is by a functional classification, and then we mix and match these terms to completely describe a particular joint. All right, so you should know what the three general structural classifications are. All right, they're by either fibrous, cartilaginous, or synovial. All right, so what kind of fiber do we find in fibrous joints? What kind of fiber would be in there? Oh, that's from the previous test. Collagen, that's right. That's the strong fiber that resists stretching, right? It's real strong, can't be pulled apart. Cartilaginous joints, all right, not nearly as strong. You would think maybe they're probably a little bit more movable. And then synovial joints, have a lot of pieces associated with them. All right, and so you got to be familiar with the synovial joint. And then online, there's a lot of good exercises for labeling synovial joints. All right, and then in terms of functional classifications, right, remember that acronym SAD, all right, and that S stands for synarthrosis. That's an immovable joint. And what's the most movable kind of joint? Yeah, it's the diarthrosis, and then one that's intermediate is the A in SAD, that's the amphiarthrosis. All right, and then here are a couple examples of these things. So we were talking about some specific examples of different kinds of joints, right, like fibrous joints, you got sutures, syndesmoses, and then the gomphosis, and a gomphosis is just a peg and socket kind of joint. So, let me see, the peg and socket kind of joint, and I don't think I mentioned this last time, all right, but don't forget there are, what's a bone-to-bone connection called? A bone-to-bone connection is a? Is a? Yes, Dr. Gober. It is a ligament, right? It's a ligament. I don't know. I think I'm losing my hearing. Probably a lot of you guys have said that. But for instance, the ligament between a tooth and this alveolar process right here, that's what we call the periodontal ligament. And so whenever you chew into something and you don't expect to bite down on something hard, you tweak a tooth and what does it feel? You get a sharp pain all of a sudden there? And that's because you're tweaking this ligament, damaging that ligament right there, the periodontal ligament. Okay. A couple kinds of cartilaginous joints, the synchondrosis versus symphysis. And they can be immovable, for instance, a synarthrosis kind of joint, like the epiphyseal disc in a long bone. So I tell you what, somebody should tell me something about an epiphyseal disc. Where do you find an epiphyseal disc? What kind of person? And what kind of bone? It's a long bone. And a person that's doing what?
Growing.
Still growing in length, right? So before puberty, that epiphyseal plate or epiphyseal disc has hyaline cartilage, right? There are osteoblasts that populate that cartilage, and so the bone is still growing in length in that area. And that joint should not be moved, because if it is moved, it damages the plate, and then the bone won't grow to its normal length after that. Okay, symphyses are united by fibrocartilage. They're slightly movable. So what's the scientific term for slightly movable, an intermediate kind of motion? That's the amphiarthrosis. All right, so the intervertebral discs and the pubic symphysis and probably the intervertebral discs are the more movable of these two kinds that we're talking about. All right, we're going to get to talking about different kinds of motion in today's lecture. That will be important. All right, and let's see. Make sure you know all these different parts of a synovial joint. And that's a joint by classification by structure because it has a bunch of structures associated with it. And these structures all provide mobility for this kind of joint. So how would we classify all synovial joints? Since every piece of it is specialized so that that joint can undergo some kind of motion. It's a? Okay. Yeah, it's the last one. S-A-D, the D, that's the diarthrosis. Okay, which is freely movable. And then the last thing that we looked at last time were some things that really kind of mimic the function and structure of a synovial joint. And they're not really joints, but they're associated with joints. They're found in between tendons and ligaments that overlie bones or muscles that otherwise would receive a lot of trauma and they would become inflamed. And these little pillows are there to reduce inflammation, to make sure that your joints, or that the accessory structures of joints like tendons and ligaments slide around properly within that joint without causing inflammation. So what are these things called? Bursa, or tendon sheets, if they're like little pillows of synovial fluid wrapped around a tendon, for instance. Okay. And, of course, those things can be inflamed if you overwork them. And then You need to rest those bursa for them to heal, or use some kind of anti-inflammatory treatment. All right, so that takes us to motions of joints. All right, I would guess that there are maybe three general kinds of motions that joints, when if it's a joint that can move, can undergo. All right, there are gliding kinds of motions, when one bone, when two flat bones just kind of glide over the surface of each other, all right, like two plates on top of each other. There are other kinds of joints that produce angular motions, all right, like for instance your elbow and your knee and even your thumb. And so let's talk about some of these, flexion and extension. Okay, a classic definition of flexion is when we have two bones, like you could pick either bone in your forearm. So let's pick the ulna. All right, which bone is that, medial or lateral? That's the medial bone and the humerus. All right, and your elbow can certainly flex and extend. So definition of flexion is when the angle between the, those two bones decreases. That's flexion. All right, and extension is going to be the opposite motion, when the angle is what? Increasing. So this is extension, this is flexion. That's a classical definition of flexion and extension. So you could think of the phalanges. All right, so if you move your phalanges like this, like to grab something, this is what we would call flexion, and then extension is when you straighten your phalanges out, just like that. Okay. Okay, so that's pretty easy to understand, flexion and extension. So for instance, your knee, okay, you can flex by what? Lifting your heel up off the ground. That's flexion. And extension is when you put your heel back down on the ground, right? When you decrease the angle, the heel comes up. Increasing the angle, the heel goes down. So when we talk about motions at joints, sometimes we talk about the motion at a joint, or the motion on the part of your body that's moving. We can use those synonymously or interchangeably. So for instance, we could say, okay, let's watch this motion right here, where the angle between the ulna and humerus is decreasing, right? That's flexion, but we should say, what is it flexing? You could say it's flexing the elbow, or you could say flexing the forearm, either way, right? So when you read a question, make sure that you can interpret it properly. Either the elbow is flexing or the forearm, okay, one or the other. Okay, now what about the hip? Okay, think of your spinal cord and your femur right here. So flexion at the hip is what? This kind of motion. An extension is bringing your heel back down while your knee is locked, for instance. So only consider the motion of the femur or the thigh. All right, so that's flexion of the hip or flexion of the thigh. Same way, right? Is like this, an extension. All right, another motion is what we call hyperextension. So with your hip, what else can you do? You can actually move it behind midline, right, out of a coronal plane. That's hyperextension. So with the hip, that's nice. You can flex and extend and even hyperextend. Now, what about your elbow? You can flex, you can extend. Can you hyperextend the elbow? Not without damaging that joint, right? So not all joints can hyperextend. And with practice, maybe you can increase range of motion right, by practicing that motion over and over again. So let's see what else. The vertebral column can be flexed. All right, so flexion of the vertebral column is when you bend forward. Okay, so this is flexion, especially you can see my cervical spine flexing. And then extension is straightening your vertebral column out. And then your vertebral column can even hyperextend a little bit, right? You can hyperextend. Okay, so that's flexion and extension. And in most cases, you should be able to figure it out. You don't have to memorize every particular joint just by knowing what? Decreasing the angle is flexion, increasing the angle is extension. With the exception of one joint, which is not intuitive. So I want to show you a little trick to help you remember that. All right, so look at my hip. And what is this motion here at the hip? That's flexion, and here is extension. Okay. The shoulder can do the same kind of thing. All right, now, here is the motion, and I'm going to go into anatomic position. All right, so I'm going to move my arm. So think of the humerus right here. I'm going to move my humerus so that it moves anteriorly. Now, is that flexion or extension? That's really hard to picture. Some people said the right answer right away. Maybe you're reading ahead, which is fantastic. But, you know, I'm not sure I see an angle changing anywhere, okay, which is getting bigger or smaller. All right, but so this is the motion. This is what we call flexion. And so when you move your humerus anteriorly and up, that's flexion. And then when you move it back down to your side, that's extension. And then, of course, this would be what? Hyperextension at the shoulder. That's very easy to do. So how is it you're going to remember that this motion is flexion at the shoulder? Okay? Because it pairs up with the hip motion. All right? So this is flexion and this is extension. Right? So just think of it pairing up just like that. And then this would be hyperextension. All right? So you know, if somebody can show me why this is decreasing an angle between a couple bones, I can't picture it, but if somebody has a nice description of why this would be flexion, okay, maybe you should show me sometime. Okay. More importantly, all right, so let's think of, all right, at the elbow, this is flexion and this is extension. These two motions are what? Opposite of each other. So we call that antagonistic motion. And this is probably the most important concept that you'll learn in a physiology or anatomy class, and that is, how do you have precise control and balance over your body, whether it is part of the nervous system or musculoskeletal system or endocrine system? It means that there has to be two mechanisms that do what with each other? They work in opposition to each other, right? So this is maybe the first example that we're talking about antagonistic motion between flexion and extension of the forearm, because maybe Friday night, okay, on the way home from work, one of those people with the fancy blue uniform and the badge and the sidearm pulled you over and said, I want you to close your eyes and do what? Put your fingertip on your nose, just like that. So what allowed you to have that precise control and balance of your fingertip to put it right on your nose like that? It's that antagonistic control, right, over your elbow joint. There are muscles in your anterior arm that cause flexion, and those have to be working together with the muscles in your posterior arm that cause extension. So it's those two muscle groups that are working together, even though in opposition to each other, so that you have precise control over your fingertip. And not just that one joint, but what? Basically all the joints of your body. So antagonism gives you precise control and balance over your body. All right, when this is just an example of the musculoskeletal system. All right, another couple terms that are antagonistic to each other is abduction and adduction. And I tell you what, let's look at a shoulder joint. So we said this is flexion, this is extension, but your shoulder, you can also do this, right? And so when you go from anatomic position to holding your hands out above the floor like this, this is abduction with a B. And if you bring your hands back down to your sides like that, that is adduction, right? So when you add your limbs to your trunk, as we call that adduction, when you move it away from midline, that's abduction. So you can certainly do that with your hip, you can do it with your shoulders, and you can do it with your toes and fingers, for instance. All right, so let's see. If you give the live long and prosper sign, okay, what is that? What kind of motion is that? With your digits. Okay, so when you spread your fingers out, that is abduction, and when you bring your fingers together, that is adduction. Right, so abduction, adduction. So you can do that with your fingers and your toes as well. All right, so that's kind of interesting because with your fingers, all right, with your digits, you can abduct and adduct. But what else can you do with your fingers? This is just a little foreshadowing of what we're going to talk about. What else could you do? You can like wave goodbye, okay? because you can flex and extend. So those are interesting joints because you have two ways you can move your digits with respect to the bones of your hand. What are those bones in the hand called again? Those are metacarpals, right? So that first joint between the metacarpal and the first phalanx right there, that's a really interesting joint because you have different ways that you can move that particular joint. You can flex and extend as well as abduct and adduct. We're going to take a look at that in a second. Okay, another kind of angular motion is what you can do with a ball and socket joint. You have two ball and socket joints in your body. One is the shoulder joint, the other is the hip. And it's a combination of flexion and extension and abduction, adduction. So when you make a windmill motion like this, this is what we call circumduction. And what are you tracing in the air? You're tracing a circle, right? So that will help you remember circumduction. You can do that with your hip and your shoulder. All right. Other kinds of motions. This first one is antagonistic as well. So always start in what? Anatomic position. Which way are your palms going to face in anatomic position? Anteriorly, okay. But you can move your hand so that the palms face posteriorly, really without moving your elbow or your shoulder or anything like that. That's what we call pronation. Or my hand is pronated right now. The opposite motion is supination. So how would you describe anatomic position? It's when your hands are supinated, right? When the palms are facing anteriorly, right? And that's the same thing as saying your hand is supinated. Okay, so how are you going to remember that one? How are you going to remember that one? You could say, well, when the palms face posteriorly, right? My palms facing posteriorly, they are pronated. Okay, so that's a lot of P's altogether. Palms posterior, pronated. All right. Or another way you could think of it, if your hands are supinated and you put them together, it forms a little fossa. Or you could say what? A soup bowl for supination, right? So supination versus pronation. So that's a pretty easy one to remember. Okay, one that maybe is not so easy has to do with your ankle. And that's because your lower limb doesn't have nearly the same kind of arrangement as your upper limb does, right? So if I was going to walk on the palms of my hands like this, okay, notice which way my elbows bend. They bend posteriorly. But what about your knee? What do? They don't bend that way. They bend anteriorly. So the arrangement of your upper limb and lower limb is kind of twisted around. So indeed, your hand at the wrist, right, if we work the wrist, this is classically what kind of motion? What about the angle? If I'm going from here to here, what about the angle of my carpals and my radius and ulna? It is increasing or decreasing? It's decreasing, so you would say this is flexion at the wrist, okay? And this would be extension at the wrist. All right, now what about the ankle? It's really kind of strange, all right? Both of the motions we consider flexion because your ankle is twisted around. When you point your toes into the ground, that's like planting your foot. We call that plantar flexion. All right? And when you lift your toes up off the ground, we call that dorsiflexion. So there's no extension at the ankle. They're both flexion movements. One is plantar flexion, the other is dorsiflexion. Okay, and it's really good to become really familiar with these kinds of motions and maybe even observe people and how they walk. You know, there was a time when doctors actually had time to see patients, right? Now you have like 5 minutes with a doctor, okay? And a patient would actually walk in the room and the doctor was there and the doctor would watch you walk in the room. And as you're walking in the room, the doctor probably would come up with that diagnosis already just by how you walked in and what demeanor you had and all different kinds of things, get a general impression of you. And one of the things still today that physicians really like to look for is if somebody is dorsiflexing or not. Okay, how would you check to see if somebody's dorsiflexing properly or not? What does dorsiflexion mean? I see some of you with a kind of confused look on your face. But you know what? Let's talk about this because maybe you could save somebody's life if we carry this out far enough. What is dorsiflexion? It has to do with your toes doing what? Lifting your toes up off the ground. Okay. So what does it mean when somebody is having trouble lifting their toes up off the ground? What are they doing? They're dragging their toes along the ground. If they can't lift their toes up, they're dragging their toes on the ground. And what's one easy way to tell and see if somebody's dragging their toes, even if they're not walking? Just look at your shoes, okay, or somebody's shoes and see if they're, okay, your shoes untied. Just kidding. But the sole of the tips of the shoes will be worn down, okay? So that's a sign that, or a signal that they're not lifting their toes up off the ground. But what in everyday activities could that be dangerous? Okay, tripping in somebody our age group, that's not such a big deal because we're still spry enough and limber enough that we'll catch ourselves before we fall. But for instance, if it's your grandmother or grandfather and they trip on something, what's likely to happen? They're going to fall, right? Unless someone is there to catch them. And one of the likely scenarios would be, well, what happens as we get older? Osteoporosis, right? So when you fall, trip on something and fall, you break a hip, which is kind of a tough thing for somebody in that age group to get over. You know, unless you're surrounded with family, you have to move into a convalescent home until the hip recovers. And somebody that age group, when you take them out of their home, away from their family, they get disoriented, right? And they kind of lose the zest for life. And a lot of people just kind of give up the ghost, right, their spirit, when they end up in a convalescent home. Okay, so just looking at something as simple as whether somebody's dorsiflexing or not can actually save their lives, right? So go ahead and look at your grandma and grandpa's shoes and see how they're doing at home. So we're going to learn later, okay, what that's a clinical sign of. If somebody can't dorsiflex, that's a nice sign for spinal cord injury. All right, so when we get into nervous system, in particular central nervous system, we'll see how that relates. Okay? Okay, so don't forget, plantar flexion, dorsiflexion. Here's another one that's a little bit hard to see. I think inversion and eversion at the ankle. All right, you can tilt your ankle medially or the soles of your feet, right? The plantar surface of your foot, you can rotate medially or laterally. And when you move the soles of your feet medially, that's what we call inversion. All right? That's relatively easy to do. You don't have a lot of strength in that kind of motion, right? You can do that. Eversion is when the soles of your feet point laterally. That's more difficult to do. There's many more ligaments that are stabilizing the ankle in that kind of motion. And when people sprain their ankles, it's mostly what? It's mostly an inversion because that's the easiest kind of motion. And if you look at my ankles, look, you can see I could probably even walk on my lateral malleolus because I've sprained my ankles so many times. All right? And unfortunately, when you stretch ligaments out, you know, they don't really get back to their normal length anymore. Okay. So that's inversion and eversion. Let's see, protraction and retraction. Protraction is when you poke a certain part of your body or you move a bone anterior, right? And you can move your clavicle anteriorly, right? And part of your scapula, that's protraction. And then moving your shoulders back, like we're all taught to do, right? That is retraction. So protraction, retraction. And you can also do that with the mandible. You can, don't chip a tooth if you practice this. If you poke your jaw out, that's protraction. And if you bring your jaw back in, that is retraction. All right, so those are a couple areas where you can do that. Elevation and depression, that's pretty easy to see. That's just another chewing motion of the TMJ. Depression of the mandible is when you open your mouth. Elevation of the mandible is when you close your mouth. And let's see, opposition, okay, there is actually two digits that can oppose each other, and that's the thumb with some other digit on your hand, right? So that's a nice motion that allows us to grasp and manipulate things very nicely, and maybe other forms of communication with sign language, for instance. Okay. So let's talk about some shapes of joints. Okay. I tell you what, here, well, let's look at some of these motions right here. Okay, some gliding motion within the carpals of your wrist to give your wrist a lot of dexterity. And here is flexion of the cervical spine. And then bringing your head back over the center of your body, that's extension, and then even hyperextension, moving your head backwards. And then here would be flexion of the vertebral column, like maybe the lumbar region, and then extension and hyperextension. That's fine. All right, so here's flexion of the leg. And then right here, we can see flexion of the arm. All right, so what does that correspond to? Flexion of the arm. What's a good way to remember that this is flexion of the arm? It should correspond to flexion of what other joint? The hip, right? Flexion, extension. Okay. And hyperextension. Circumduction is tracing a circle, and adduction is when you bring some part of your body toward midline. Abduction is when you move it away from midline. Ah, okay, here's one that I didn't mention. All right, rotation. Okay, rotation is due to some kind of pivoting. For instance, this motion, typically we call this the no motion. So here's a right lateral rotation, a left lateral rotation. And that happens within the cervical spine, and you should be aware what two bones allow you to rotate your head. What is the most important joint for lateral rotation? Yeah, it's between C1 and C2, or the atlantoaxis joint, okay, because of the dens, not between the occipital bone and C1. All right, so what other joints can you rotate? Well, you can rotate, to some degree, your humerus, right? You can rotate your femur, and there's even a special joint in your elbow. The joint between the ulna and the humerus is strictly a hinge joint for flexion and extension, but that's not the only motion. What else can you do with your hand besides just kind of wave it up and down? You can have it supinated, or you can pronate it, right? You can pronate and supinate. So there has to be a pivot joint, all right, in the elbow. And let's see if I have a picture. I don't think I have a really good picture in this chapter of that. All right, except here we can see a picture of the radius and the ulna. And when the hand is pronated, notice that the radius crosses over the ulna, because at the radial humeral joint up over here, there's a pivot joint where the head of the radius is articulating. Oh, and you should know this. What does the head of the radius articulate with? What part of the humerus? It's the thing that kind of looks like a little ball or sphere. It's called the, starts with a C, the capitulum. All right, the head of the radius articulates with the capitulum, and that is a pivot joint. All right, and the head of the radius also articulates with a certain little notch in the ulna. What was that little notch called in the ulna? Okay, that's the radial notch, the radial notch. Okay. Okay. Ah, this is not a bad picture right here. Maybe we can see this. All right, so this condylar surface, this is the one we just mentioned. Go ahead, tell us what this is. That is the capitulum that articulates with the head of the radius. And then this condylar surface is what we call the trochlea. It articulates with the ulna, and in particular the trochlear notch. All right, so the trochlea and the trochlear notch, okay, allow for what? A nice hinge motion. But the joint between the capitulum and the head of the radius, along with this radial notch within the ulna, allows for pronation and supination as well. All right, so these two articulations you should become very familiar with, the head of the radius and the capitulum, and the trochlear notch of the ulna and the trochlea. Okay. All right, so a plane type joint, all right, or transitional joint, would, some examples would be the intertarsal joints and intercarpal joints. All right, so that would be in the ankle and in the wrist. Okay, so here are some plane joints for just sliding back and forth. And a really good example of a hinge joint, all right, would be the joint between, what is this surface right here? This is the trochlear notch of the ulna, and this is the trochlea of the humerus. All right, so this is just a uniaxial hinge joint. And, oh, perfect example of a pivot joint. It's uniaxial as well. All right, so this is the joint where the head of the radius articulates with what? The radial notch within the humerus for what kind of motion does this provide for? When your hands face posteriorly, we call that pronation. And when your palms face anteriorly, that is supination. All right, so that's a really nice pivot joint. The joint between these following bones, okay? So here we see some carpals. So where are we here? If these are carpals, is this a hand? Yes, hand as opposed to the foot, okay? So these bones right here, what are all these bones? These are metacarpals, right? So these are the bones that make up the hand, right? And here is a special kind of joint between the metacarpals and the first phalanges right here. This is what we call a condyloid joint. And a condyloid joint is not like a hinge, which only has 1 degree of motion, 1 degree of freedom. These joints can move in 2 directions. Right, they can be what? Hinge joints, right, for flexion and extension, but they can also do this kind of motion. What was this? This was abduction and abduction, right, because that's a special joint right there. That's a condyloid joint, allowing those two types of motion. All right. Another kind of motion, a saddle joint, right, between the first metacarpal and this carpal right here. This is a saddle joint, right, and that's a special joint. What does that, so it allows for flexion and extension, abduction, adduction, but it also allows for, the saddle joint allows for when you move your hand, I mean your thumb anterior, that is opposition. Right, so that's another really nice complicated kind of joint that allows for opposition. All right, so I think a good point to make here is what determines the motion of a particular joint or the function of a particular joint? What determines the function of a particular joint? It's the particular structure of that joint. Right, so if the structure is such that it forms this hinge, right, this joint can only move in a flexion and extension mode, right? It can't abduct, it can't adduct. All right, so the structure of a joint determines what the function of that particular joint will be. All right, and then the last kind of joint is very complicated. This is a ball and socket joint. And the two ball and socket joints are what, the glenohumeral joint, the shoulder joint, and then the hip joint as well. Okay, and so this allows for abduction, adduction, flexion, extension, rotation, and if we add all of those motions up together, what do we get? We get circumduction, right? So circumduction with the shoulder and the hip joint. Okay, here you can see. All right, so one joint that I do want you to spend some time knowing, especially in lab. One last thing I want to talk about before we get to the one joint that you have to know a lot about is the shoulder joint right here. And so here we see the head of the humerus. Here is the glenoid cavity. And notice that the glenoid cavity is really shallow compared to the ball and socket joint of the hip. What do we call the socket of the hip joint? The acetabulum, right? So here's the glenoid cavity. So the acetabulum is very, very deep, so it's a very strong kind of joint, right? The shoulder is not nearly as strong, but there is something that enhances the depth of the glenoid cavity, right? And can you see some fibrocartilage right here and right here? All right, so these are some projections off of the surface of the glenoid cavity that actually increase the depth of the shoulder joint, right? And these are little fibrocartilage projections, right? And these things are what we call, that this is the superior labrum and inferior labrum, right? So the function of this labrum is to do what? Is to increase the stability of a shoulder joint, right? Because it increases the depth of the fossa. All right, but now what's the trade-off though? Okay, to having a labrum here instead of a piece of bone that is sticking out. What do you think is more difficult, which is more easily damaged? Fibrocartilage or bone? Fibrocartilage, that's right. So it's relatively easy to rip this, what we call the glenoid labrum, all right, when, for instance, if the shoulder is dislocated, all right, so the labrum can be damaged as a result. It just helps stabilize the shoulder joint. It makes the socket a little bit deeper. So let's trace the depth of the glenoid cavity, okay, without the labrum. You see, it starts right here, a little small depression, and then it ends right here. But with the addition of the labrum, you see what? It's a deeper socket, both superiorly and inferiorly. So that stabilizes the shoulder joint, makes it a little bit more stable. It's fibrocartilage, yeah. Okay. Okay. When we get to muscles, I'm going to talk some more about the shoulder, but probably not so much in bone, not the skeletal or the articulation chapter. All right. But now here's the joint that I do want you to know. Maybe some of you have seen some of these figures in your study guide. And this is the knee, right? So I want you to know basically all the pieces of the knee joint. And it's actually pretty easy to learn the knee compared to some of these other structures. Okay. Okay, so the muscles that you have in your thigh, okay, all insert into this common tendon right here, which we call tendon of the quadriceps femoris, because all these muscles in your anterior thigh work to perform a certain kind of motion, which is, what is this motion right here? Oops. This is extension of the knee or extension of the leg. Okay. And guess how many muscles there are right here? That tells you in the name. Yeah, there are four quadriceps, right? Quadra meaning four. So there are four muscle groups that all insert into the patella and then insert into this rough anterior process of the tibia. What did we call? What did you learn? This anterior process of the tibia. What's that called? That's the tibial tuberosity, right? That tibial tuberosity. All right. So you got to know the quadriceps that cause extension of the knee, the patella. This is a little bone that helps adjust the angle so that the quadriceps can perform an angular motion and not just elevate the tibia up toward the femur, but can actually cause an angular motion. And the patellar ligament. Right? Now, why do we call this structure right here a tendon, as opposed to this structure down here, we call it a ligament? Because here we have a muscle to bone connection, and then this lower attachment is what? A bone to bone connection. Right? So that's just the definition of a tendon and a ligament. All right, so those are two things you have to know. Two other ligaments you have to be aware of. And there are two ligaments that help stabilize the knee and prevent abduction and adduction at the knee. So what is abduction again? Abduction is moving away right from midline. Adduction is moving toward midline. Or you could use your fingers as well. All right, so this knee joint, right, shouldn't bend in terms of adduction, shouldn't bend in terms of abduction. All right, so what can a knee joint do? What kind of motion is the knee joint? You can flex the knee and extend the knee. Right? And what do we call that? What kind of joint does that? That's just a pure and simple hinge joint. Right? So your lower leg shouldn't bend out like that at the knee or bend in at the knee. Right? I suppose it can with trauma, but guess what's going to happen? Something's going to break, right, in a really bad way. All right, so what prevents, well, I tell you what, let's figure out if we can understand where these bones are. So we see two bones in the leg. We got the tibia and fibula. And which one is going to be the medial bone? Which one's medial? The tibia, this one right over here, right? So the fibula is lateral. So these we call collateral ligaments that go from the femur to the fibula or from the femur to the tibia right here. And the lateral collateral ligament or the fibular collateral ligament, right, prevents the bending toward midline, which is what? What do we call bending toward midline? Bending toward midline is adduction. So the lateral collateral ligament, and you can either call it the fibular collateral ligament, that prevents adduction at the knee. And the medial collateral ligament, or the tibial collateral ligament, prevents what kind of motion at the knee? The, right, bending outward. Bending outward is what we call abduction. Okay. But if you do abduct or adduct at the knee inappropriately, like if you get hit from the side or something, then it's the collateral ligaments, right, that are going to rip off of the bones or break or tear or whatever. All right, so those are three ligaments in a tendon that we're familiar with now, the collateral ligaments, right, and the patellar ligament and the tendon of the quadriceps femoris. Okay. Ah, here's a really good exam figure. So we see what? The collateral ligaments, the lateral and the medial collateral ligament. But there are also some ligaments that prevent protraction and retraction of the tibia. All right, so what would that be like? Protraction and retraction. So I guess maybe I'll use my two hands, right? So Here would be the femur, and then down over here would be the tibia and fibula. And protraction of the tibia would be what? When the tibia moves in front of, anterior to the femur. That does not look good, because what should this joint do, basically? It should only flex and extend. It shouldn't protract and retract. So there are ligaments that prevent protraction, and that would be the anterior cruciate ligament. All right, so these are cruciate ligaments on the inside of the knee, right on midline. And they cross over each other. They form an X, so we call these the cruciate ligaments. So here is the anterior cruciate ligament that prevents protraction of the tibia. And then here is the posterior cruciate ligament, which prevents what? Retraction of the tibia with respect to the femur. All right, so those two motions shouldn't happen as well. But if that does happen due to trauma, then that's what would damage these cruciate ligaments right here. Yeah. Yeah, the sign-in sheet sounds good. It's right here. Go ahead. Pass it around. All right, so what do we got now? We've got the quadriceps tendon. We've got the patellar ligament, the lateral collateral ligament, the medial collateral ligament, anterior cruciate, posterior cruciate. So you should know what those ligaments are doing for stabilizing your knee. All right, there's one last item within the knee that helps stabilize the knee, and it is the articular disc. So there is an articular disc made out of fibrocartilage. There are two of them. We don't really call it an articular disc. We call it a meniscus, right? Okay. And so here is a lateral meniscus. Here's the medial meniscus. And you know this is the medial one because you see the tibia right here, right, which is medial. And the menisci, right, have a certain shape to them. So if you think of a letter of the alphabet, what do they look like? They look like a C, yeah. So we call them C-shaped menisci. And they're really thick out by the sides, like the most medial margin of the medial meniscus is very, very thick, and the lateral part of the lateral meniscus is very, very thick. But they get thinner and thinner and thinner as they come toward the center of the condyles. All right, so I tell you what, when you damage a meniscus, what do you think is easier to do? Damage a thin part or a thick part of it? The thin parts, that's right. So these are what we call, sometimes we call these the little horns of the meniscus. They can be ripped and they can break off and they can even float around inside the capsule or the cavity, the synovial cavity of the knee. And you can imagine what that would be like because it can act like a little doorstop or a wedge between the parts of a knee, and somebody's knee can actually get locked into position if that meniscus tears and flops into a position where it doesn't belong. All right, and we would just call that a torn meniscus. And menisci, because they're fibrocartilage, they don't have much of a vascular supply, so once they're damaged, right, they really don't heal. And the only treatment then is to make sure that it's removed. I don't know if anybody transplanting menisci, but maybe somebody's thinking about doing that. That'd be really nice. Another nice technique maybe in the future is actually to take some stem cells from somebody and actually grow a meniscus for them and then transplant it back into their body, right? That would be really nice to protect the condylar surfaces of the femur and the tibia right here. Years ago, when somebody had a torn meniscus, the surgery was pretty fast and easy because they would just remove the whole meniscus, get it out of the way. All right, but can you imagine what might happen to somebody's knee if a whole meniscus, a complete meniscus, was removed? Okay, what would happen then? Well, then the condylar surfaces of the femur and the tibia would, what, rub up against each other, and they would get worn down. What do we call that? That's arthritis, right? So now when somebody has a torn meniscus, they do a lot of really nice imaging studies, and that's probably why it wasn't done in very early years, because now we have some really nice imaging modalities, for instance, like MRIs. We can see exactly where that tear is. We can plan the surgery really nicely to remove the torn part, but to preserve what as much of the meniscus as possible, because that meniscus is allowing for the proper function of that knee and protecting the knee from arthritis. All right, so that's just the call of your particular physicians, what's best for you. All right, so can you name these things, these parts of the knee? So in lab we have a number of really good knee models. All right, so don't forget the fibula is lateral, So here's the lateral collateral ligament, or if you want to call it the fibular collateral ligament, that's fine. Here's the medial collateral or the tibial collateral ligament. These prevent what? Abduction and adduction at the knee. Should never bend that way. And the anterior and posterior cruciate prevent protraction and retraction at the knee. So that the proper motion, what's the proper motion at the knee? It's purely flexion and extension. Right? So those ligaments are really important. And the shape of the meniscus also helps ensure that the knee is basically a hinge joint. Okay, and not acting like a condyloid joint, for instance, in your hand. All right, so I think you got these different couple presentations. All right, so here we see, okay, the lateral meniscus, the medial meniscus. There's a couple other ligaments in here that I'm not going to ask you to know. Like I see one right here. If you're interested in knowing even more about the knee, you can see me and we can talk about other aspects of the knee. All right, so now can you get an appreciation of the cruciate ligaments right here? They are crossing over each other. And the insertion of these ligaments is right into the intercondylar notch of the tibia. Can you picture where the intercondylar eminence, right? There is a bony process that's sticking up from the condylar surfaces of the tibia, and that's what's holding these cruciate ligaments in position. The other nice thing that we can see with the knee is that here is the prepatellar bursa, right? Just anterior to the patella. And then there's an infrapatellar bursa and a suprapatellar bursa right here. So what's the job of all of these bursa of the knee? Yeah, lubrication and basically defeat inflammation when the knee is moving. So these just act as like little pillows of lubrication between, right, these very strong muscles. For instance, the suprapatellar bursa protects the femur from contraction of these very strong muscles in the anterior thigh, namely the quadriceps. And when these muscles contract, that puts a lot of tension on the tendon of the quadriceps, which is going to bang up against the femur, but that suprapatellar bursa prevents that inflammation and absorbs some of that trauma. Okay, and the same thing for the other bursa of the knee. Okay, so this is not an exam figure. I don't think this is an exam figure, but this one might be, I'm not sure, but this one for sure is. Okay, so make sure that you can label all of these things. Okay, so this one right here, important synovial joints. Okay, for the lecture class, you know, maybe I would delete shoulder and it's just going to be the knee joint for lecture. All right, so does anybody have any questions about motions or kinds of joints? Okay, so that's it for articulations. All right, so I guess I would urge all of you to go onto Blackboard and work some of those exercises and give me some feedback, which ones you think are helpful and which ones you don't think are so helpful. And maybe I would delete some that you don't think are so helpful, or maybe I would maybe try to convince you otherwise. I'm not sure, okay? But we can discuss that. All right, so you know what? I think that's it for today, okay? So I don't know where's the sign-in sheet at? It's over here. Okay, pass it around a little bit quicker.